And we are here on Easter to celebrate that, to celebrate the God who has told us his story that all leads to one point. Every story whispers his name. Every story tells us of the victory that Christ has won for us. Every story leads us to the morning of the resurrection, where the women went to the tomb and found it empty, and where Jesus appeared to his followers. This story defines all of history. It defines the entire Bible. And hopefully this morning we will come to find out that if that story is our story, if we are pulled into the story, we find our hope in that story, it will change us. We've spent the last several months reading and studying this really, really awesome Old Testament book that is actually the story and the events happened about 1,500 years before Jesus came. But what we found out all through the story is that the story has been unfolding, revealing the way that God saves people. And there are images and pictures of Jesus all the way through. Now, we did this because back around Christmas, Hollywood decided to give us a movie on the book of Exodus, Exodus, Gods and Kings. And I thought, you know, this is going to be a topic of conversation in our culture. People are going to be talking about the story of Exodus because there is a movie coming out. And then only three people went and saw it, and nobody's talking about it. But we got, you know, Moses played by Batman. And you know, and it was an interesting take, and you know, the computer graphics and things like that were amazing. They kind of played around with the story of Exodus a little bit and didn't quite get it right, but that's okay. But it has given us as a church a chance to wade through this amazing story of God's redemptive plan and how he rescues and redeems people. And like I said, everything in the story creates shadows, almost creates a thirst in us to say, man, this is cool, but there's got to be something else beyond the story. And what we know as we read the Bible is that that something else beyond the story is the coming of Jesus, his death and resurrection. Now, that doesn't mean we always get it right away. Sometimes wading through this and figuring this out takes a while, and it's like putting it all together and just you know, understanding everything that goes on in the Bible and the story of Jesus can be hard. We found that in the life of my now 10-year-old son when he was like 3 or 4. He got some issues kind of mixed up a little bit. For example, he was hanging out at a babysitter's house one time, and she served them Cheez-Its. And my Josiah said, Cheez-Its, I love Cheez-Its. And she's like, oh, that's awesome. I'm glad that you love Cheez-Its. And he said, I just love Cheez-Its. In fact, I pray to Cheez-Its. And she said, well, what? And she knew that, like, what we do as a family, that how we do church. He said, yeah, I pray to Cheez-Its. And she's like, I don't understand. What do you mean? Do you mean you pray to Jesus? And he went, oh, yeah, that's it. And so then he started going around talking about the fact that people would be talking to him about the cross and the story of Easter, and they would say, you know, Jesus died on the cross, and he said, no, Andy died on the cross. And his older brother is Andy, and he was going, Andy died. No, Jesus died on the cross. Oh, no, my parents told me Andy died on the cross. Now, we hadn't told him this, and we couldn't figure out why he did this. He kept saying to all these people, Andy died on the cross. No, it's Jesus who died on the cross. No, it's Andy. Andy died on the cross. And so we finally sat him down and said, buddy, listen, we got to explain this. I don't know where you got this, but Jesus died on the cross, not Andy. He's like, okay. Well, then about 2 weeks later, we went to one of Andy's lacrosse games, and we got out of the car, and we said, we're here to see Andy play lacrosse, and he said, I thought it was Jesus in lacrosse. Sometimes it takes us a little while to get these facts straight, right? But the Bible as a whole is telling us this beautiful story of God's rescue mission, his redemptive plan. And Exodus has been this really cool picture of this. And so this morning, I just want to kind of help you wrestle with the big storyline of the Bible as it is told through Exodus. And then as that story comes forward, and show you how even in the Old Testament, even 1,500 years before Jesus came, God was writing his story. He was telling us his character. He was displaying his faithfulness and his goodness. And I'm going to show you how that story, I hope to show you how that story leads us to this story that we're celebrating about Jesus dying and rising again. But my hope this morning is that that story will be your story, that God will draw you in to experience the wonder of the gospel, the good news of Jesus that is on display in every page, every word, every story that is pointing us to what God has done. And so what happens in the story is that in Exodus begins with a promise that was made 400 years earlier, about 700 years earlier to this man named Abraham. And Abraham had followed God, and God had spoken to him and made a whole bunch of promises. And the promises included that one day, from Abraham's descendants, that God would make a great nation, that there would be this huge nation. God told Abraham, listen, your descendants will be greater than even the stars of the sky, than the sand of the seashore. I mean, he's picturing this huge number of people. And the problem at the time is that Abraham was an old dude and didn't have any babies. He didn't have any kids. And his wife was old and didn't have any children. And the craziness of the story is that Abraham's 99 years old and his wife Sarah is 90 and they have a kid. I'm telling you, that's nuts, right? My wife and I had twins when we were a little over 40. She was right at 40. We had twins. Having kids at 40 is nuts. Having kids at 90 is like outside of my realm of understanding. But here's this old guy, and we know like 99-year-old people, 90-year-old women don't have babies unless there is a God who is up to something. And he had made promises, and he is faithful, and they had a baby. And then that son had a son, and that son had two sons. And then what happens is we have this growing family, and God makes these crazy, amazing promises about the greatness of this family becoming a nation and the promise that one day he would give this nation of descendants of Abraham a land, and he is going to be faithful to this. And then he says, not only am I going to make you a great nation, not only am I going to give your descendants a place to live, but all the nations on the earth will be blessed because of your offspring, because of one of your kids. And so what happens is this dude becomes a family. 400 years later, that family has become a nation, but that nation, those people are living in slavery, and it's horrible. And one of those families had a couple of sons. One of the sons' name is Aaron. I want to talk to you this morning about Aaron's experience. I want you to get into his skin for a few minutes. I want you to feel what's going on in the world of Aaron. When Aaron was 3 years old, the king, Pharaoh, who was already putting his people under a massive yoke of slavery, a massive weight that it was impossible for them to carry. And they couldn't solve their problem. They were losing hope. They knew that they were the descendants of this guy who had promises, but those promises were made 400 years ago, and their whole experience didn't look anything like the promises of God. And then when he's about 3 years old, the king made a decree that said every baby boy must die. We're going to throw every baby boy from this nation, these people who are in slavery, into the Nile River. And through a crazy story, it may have been like his earliest memory, a crazy story, God used his sister and his mom to rescue his little brother, whose name is Moses. And Moses ends up being found by the princess, one of the daughters of Pharaoh himself. And Moses, his brother, gets raised both in the house of Pharaoh by the Egyptians, and he gets raised in the house of Israel with his mother serving as his own nanny. And he grows up, and this is his house. He, his mom and dad, his brother and a sister named Miriam is what we know about, and his family, while his brother is, younger brother is kind of living this life of privilege, his life growing up is very hard. He is the descendant of slaves who becomes a slave himself. And he grows up and he has a family. But that family who has these memories, has these stories, has this faith that is passed down to them, it is a faith that is distant. It is a faith that is far. It is a faith that is disconnected because their experience looks nothing like what they have had. And I imagine when they sat around in circles, there was a lot of talk that was filled with platitudes, little short sayings, hoping to give hope. But you know how that's just often people want to help you by saying, you know, everything's going to be all right. God is with us, but it's just hard to resonate with our experience with those kind of things. We live in 144 character culture, right? If you're not on Twitter, you have no idea what I'm talking about. If you are, we live in a character where we try to solve everybody's problems in 144 characters or less. Short platitudes, short pithy statements that hopefully will rise up and give people hope. You know, we are a just a snapshot, quick, let's just say it simply and post it on Instagram with a picture, or let's post it on Twitter. That's where we will get our hope. And so a lot of us, like, our whole deal is we sit around all day just reading Twitter and looking at Instagram and checking out social media, hoping maybe to find something that will brighten our day and make us feel better about our lives. But then we go on about our lives, and little cute, pithy statements, little sound bites don't sink deep into the soul. I mean, they're well-meaning. It's not that they don't have any place. It's just that sometimes those sound bites, those pithy statements, those 144-character tweets, man, they look good when they are on my phone, but when they really relate to my life, there's just nothing that really helps me. And so we have pithy statements like what the mind can conceive, it can achieve. And that sounds beautiful, but in the morning, if I wake up tomorrow morning and I'm Aaron and my life is in slavery, that's not going to help me a whole lot. Or if I get a tweet that says, God has a plan for you, but I'm living with my kids growing up knowing that there is no hope for their life, that's just not real helpful. Or if I get a tweet that says, follow your passion. Man, that feels great. I mean, that's kind of the American way of doing things, saying, listen, we can just follow our passion, all will be right. But the truth is that if you're 5'2" and 125 pounds and really slow, you can be as passionate about football as you want. You are not playing in the NFL. And sound bites, man, they're great, and we love to retweet them or pass them on. Age is just a number. I'm finding out that is a lie. Pithy statements, sound bites. God never gives us more than we can bear. Sometimes life's pretty heavy. And here's Aaron growing up and becoming a man and having a family, but his family has no hope. All he has is these memories with his people of some promise that was made by a God who seems very distant 400 years ago. But what he doesn't know is that God is already at work. His brother ended up killing a man. So his little brother, who seemed to live this life of privilege, ends up killing a man and ends up exiled, and he's gone for 40 years. But what Aaron doesn't know is that at the moment this is going on, that God is already taking the initiative to bring redemption to Aaron and his boys and his family and his people. He doesn't know that God is already at work around him because he just can't see it yet, but it is happening. We through this series, for those of you who are guests or hanging out, you're going, what's all the pictures? This series, what we've been trying to do is every sermon, we've had people in our church create a painting that pictures where we're at in the story. We're trying to tell the story visually of Exodus through these paintings. We've had some amazing ones. But as Aaron goes through the story, we know that he's in Egypt in slavery. And without him even knowing this goes on, God meets Moses in this crazy event, his brother, in this event that is called the Burning Bush Experience, where God meets Moses face to face and calls him, sends him back to Pharaoh. And Moses goes back to Pharaoh, kind of scared. And Moses grabs his brother. And now Aaron, who's been waiting his whole life for some form of redemption, some form of hope, but is raising a family in a place where every day their life is hard and brutal and there's nothing for them, nothing to give them hope. And Moses comes back and confronts Pharaoh, and Pharaoh makes their life worse. Makes their life worse. And so what happens is that God tells through Moses and Aaron, Aaron begins to go with his brother to confront Moses. And as they go in front of the Pharaoh, the king, really the king of the world, and they're telling Pharaoh, listen, the one true God is telling you to let his people go. And Pharaoh goes, I'm not letting your people go. Get back to work. And if you keep coming to me, I'm going to make your life terrible. I'm going to make your life harder. And he begins to do this. But God begins to send these crazy, miraculous signs. They're called plagues, that are both acts of deliverance for his people, but acts of judgment towards the Egyptians as they are hardening their hearts toward the one true God. And then they're doing genocide and slavery and all this kind of stuff. And God is acting for his people. and they begin to see his hand, his power on display. There is no way they can remedy their condition. There is no way out, but God begins to act on their behalf. And what happens is after these 10 plagues, we get to the 10th plague, and there is this story of the Passover, where they literally are told to kill a lamb, and the sacrifice of this lamb, they're to cover their door, and the covering on the door is painting a picture for us. It is painting a picture of the fact that God, when he brings justice, he passes over the homes where the blood of the lamb has covered the doorpost. And Aaron watches this happen. He is sitting with his family one night in his house, eating lamb, eating wafers of unleavened bread, and celebrating the very first Passover with his family. And he feels the weight of the moment as there's just something crazy. And he begins to hear wailing out in the distance of people who have lost a son because of this event. But God, in his mercy, not because his people deserved it, in his mercy, has passed over the Hebrew people who've put the blood on the doorpost. And now Pharaoh says, go, just leave, get out of here. And so in the middle of the night, Aaron wakes his family up, and Aaron grabs them and says, come on, we got to go. We're supposed to leave here. And they gather all the people, and they grab what they can as fast as they can. They put it on their backs. They grab their sheep and their animals, and they begin to take them with them. And they begin to exit, and they leave Egypt, and God has given them victory. They are slaves no more, at least for the moment. And there's probably singing and rejoicing in a moment of celebration as they're like, listen, our hopes have been realized. We are free people. God has saved us. God has rescued us. But they get out in the wilderness and they come to this ginormous body of water, the Red Sea. And all of a sudden they're there and they're looking at the Red Sea in front of them thinking, how are we going to get around this? And then they probably hear a trumpet blast at the very back of the people. And as they turn around, they realize that Pharaoh has gotten angry again. And now he has grabbed his army and all of his chariots and they are hunting them down. And they've gone from hopeless because we're slaves to hopeless because we are dead. We are going to die. Our bodies are going to be thrown into this sea. And that's going to be the end of our story. And Moses cries out to God. His brother cries out to God. And then his brother takes a few steps out into the water and takes this amazing staff that God gave him, put it in the water, and he is there to see the most amazing thing ever, as all of a sudden this wind comes. There's this fire that creates a barrier between the Egyptians and his people, and he's huddling near his family terrified. All of a sudden the water starts to part, and the next thing you know, this sea has dry ground, and he grabs his kids and they begin to walk. And I imagine some people were seeing this going, oh my gosh, this is amazing, right? I mean, if it was us, we'd be taking selfies all the way through, right? Some people are walking across on dry ground going, yes, this is amazing, what a God. And some people are walking across on dry ground going, we're going to die, we're going to die, we're going to die. We're not going to make it. This is not a good idea. But the whole nation, whether their faith was strong, their faith was weak, the whole nation was saved. They walked through on dry ground. They passed through the Red Sea. And at the end, the water closes in, a final victory over Pharaoh. They have been saved through atonement as God covered their sin, and through victory as that God took dead people and gave them new life, right? And they've passed through the Red Sea, and now they come, and they begin to have this beautiful picture of God's promises being fulfilled in them, and he sees them through. And then God makes promises to them, and he draws them to himself, and they come to this amazing mountain where they will meet their God. And he gives them this crazy word, it's called a covenant, where God makes promises and an agreement, and he says, listen, I will be your God. You are my people. I have already redeemed you. I have already acted. I have already worked in your life, and I have brought you to myself. And in that, God makes promises, but he also gives laws. And the whole point is that God is telling his people, listen, you have a different king. The world serves all kinds of other deities, all kinds of other kings, but you have met the one true God. He has acted for you. And the thing you need to realize as you study and read Exodus is this. They could have done nothing to make this happen. God did everything. It was not their faith. It was not their might. It was not their ability. actually, they had no faith, they had no might, total inability. And Aaron has now watched as he and his wife and his family and his brother and his whole clan and like everybody around him have been rescued. And in this amazing place where God is giving them this covenant, this relationship agreement where he's saying, listen, I will be your God, you will be my people. And he's given them some of these laws. This section ends with God saying, I made a promise to Abraham. I'm not done with you. There is a land of promise. I am going to lead you there. And when you get there, you will have victory again as you take the land, because I promised I would do it, and I am faithful. And every step of the way, this is what we find out about God's people. They are not. They are not faithful. They blow it at every moment. But what we find at every step of the way is that God is a faithful, good God. And God is telling us his story. He is telling us this morning that he is a faithful God who redeems and rescues and delivers from slavery, who saves the people through covering their sin, who redeems dead people and makes them alive, and he passes them from death to life as they pass through the waters of the sea. And God is rescued people. And now, and when we get to Exodus 24, this all gets us to this one really cool place where Exodus 24 is like the culmination of what's happened in the story. God has now had this conversation with the people, and at first he said, all right, here's this mountain. This is my mountain. This is where I'm going to meet my people. And he created a barrier, and he said, listen, you cannot let the people come up this mountain on their own terms, because if they do, they will meet me, and it will not go well. I am a God who is holy, who is perfect, who in his grace, but in his glory, will not tolerate the sinfulness of people. You just cannot come willy-nilly into our presence. Into my presence. But now he is going to invite Moses and Aaron and his boys and 70 other people to come up the mountain where they will meet their God face to face. So if you have a Bible, grab it. We're going to read this story together. Exodus chapter 24. Exodus chapter 24. We're going to read verses 1 through 11. And I'm going to make some comments about what's going on here and then show you how this gets us to Luke 24 and the story of the resurrection. If you don't have a Bible, we would love for you to take one at the end of the row. Pass them down, make sure everybody has one. You can read along with us. Luke chapter 24. And this man and his boys who were once in slavery are going to get to climb a mountain where they will meet the one true God face to face. Then he, meaning God, said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, that's Aaron's boys, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. And Moses alone shall come up to the Lord, but the others shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with him. In other words, there is a level of representation here. I'm not going to go in a lot of detail, but what God is doing is he's inviting them to himself into relationship, and they are now going to represent the whole people of God coming together as the leaders of Israel. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and all the rules, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Now, this is what's going on in this story right here. Here's the big word. It is the covenant ratification. In other words, God has said, I've already worked for you. I've already rescued you. I've already redeemed you. I've already acted. I've already displayed my power. I've already delivered you through the sea. I've already brought you to myself. Now, I will be your God. You will be my people. But the people have to say, we're in. We believe. We're placing our faith in God. We're not trusting ourselves. We are trusting in you. And because we place our faith in God, you are our king now, and we will live under what you want us to do. And so that's what they do. They say, we're in. We will do what you said. We will trust you. You are our king. Now, I've already told you this. I'll tell you again. They're terrible at it. They have to come back and make this commitment over and over and over in the Old Testament. There are a ton of covenant renewal ceremonies where they come back and go, all right, we didn't do it. I mean, you know, we have this with our kids all the time, right? You look at your kids and say, I don't want you to do that. And then they're like, tomorrow. And you're like, I told you not to do that. And you're like, I'm sorry, I won't do it again, mommy. I probably, you have that, right? This is their whole story, the Old Testament. And so they say, we will do this. All that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. And he rose early in the morning, and he built an altar at the foot of the mountain, and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men to the people of Israel and offered burnt offering and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it on the basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient. And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. And how many of you are like, all right, y'all pull out a basin of blood and start throwing it, we're out. All right, I'll explain what's going on here in just a minute. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. This is a beautiful, beautiful passage about God's goodness and his grace. And so what happens in the story is that they are making a journey of repentance and faith, of what it looks like when God has acted. And now they're saying, listen, this is a great story, but this is now our story. We are in. You are our God. We are going to live with you as our king. And they go from a God who just has platitudes, who just has sound bites, to a God who is in their midst, and they are with him. And this journey has kind of four markers. This journey up the mountain has four markers that we're going to find out these markers are always there in the scriptures. They're calling us to. It's the journey we need to take this morning as we look at the cross and the resurrection, okay? The first marker is this, is they're coming up the journey. There was a book. In other words, there is this covenant, this relationship agreement where God says, I'm God, you are not, but I am your God, you are going to be my people. And this is the first thing they must say. They must stand up. If they're going to understand this whole idea of the one true God, if they're going to embrace the story of God as their story, it has to begin by them going, there is a book that has revealed God to us, and he's God, I'm not. I'm giving myself to the one who has shown himself to us and has written his story in the scriptures. And so there is a book with regulations, with rules, with things that they are to do. They were looking at this saying, listen, I don't run my life anymore. We've already talked about Twitter and social media. Listen, we're a like and a follow culture where I get to say who I like and who I don't like, and I get to follow and unfollow who I want to. But if we're going to understand the gospel and understand what's being told in the story of God, we must understand that there is a God, and he is calling us to see who he is and to hold on to him. And so what happens is there is a book, and the book is read, and the people say, we're going to do it. We're in. We believe. We trust who this God is, and we are giving ourselves to him. There is a book, and the book is calling us to realize that he can be our God. We can be his people, but he is God, right? And so there's a book, and then second, there's an altar. There's an altar. They build this altar at the base of the mountain, and on the altars there's 12 stones, and each of the stones represents 12 tribes, these 12 tribes of Israel, and there's an altar, and they do this crazy thing where they sacrifice an animal, and they throw blood on the altar, and they throw blood on the people, and it's really bloody and really weird, and all of a sudden we see these sacrifices in the Old Testament always follow this pattern. I mean, is like the whole idea, okay, you're God, but man, you're into bloody animal stuff. That ought to bother us. It's supposed to. It's supposed to. See, what happens anytime you come to a sacrifice in the Bible, what ought to be going on is all of a sudden we ought to realize, listen, this God is a perfect God. He is perfect in his character. He is perfect in his being. He is sinless. I mean, and we want a God who is perfect. If he's not perfect, we're in trouble. But how can a God who is perfect look at me as an imperfect, broken, rebellious person and ever give me a relationship with himself? And the answer is that the only way that's possible is for God to accept a substitute, something that dies in my place. And so in the Old Testament, animals are used to paint a picture. Now, we don't believe that animals really covered people's sin, but it painted a picture of the fact that one day God would send a true sacrifice who would. And so what happens with the sacrifice is, first of all, the blood is poured on the altar. The altar is the place where the sacrifice is given. And this is a picture of God's anger. Like, God already, like, he is determined not to let evil win, right? And here's our problem today, okay? We live in a world of injustice. And injustice means that the world is broken, that there are things wrong. We want a world where justice happens. And all of us have had injustice done to us. We've had things that have broken, like come to us, that have left us broken, that have left us hurting. We have had wrongs done to us. For Aaron and his family, he's had Pharaoh and the Egyptians who have put them in slavery, have made their lives terrible. And injustice has been done to us. But the problem is, I have also done injustice to others. I've hurt people, I've wronged people, I've done things that were broken and have left deep wounds in people. And I didn't necessarily mean to, although sometimes, yes, I did. And so I want justice for me, but I don't want the justice that is due me. And what the Bible's doing is it's letting us know, as God is telling his story, that God loves us, he is for us, but our sin is super costly. And so his wrath is covered at the altar, and then the picture of blood being sprinkled is a picture of the blood covering and cleansing us. What can wash away our sin? Nothing but the blood of Jesus, right? This is the picture that's being painted in the story of the Bible. And so there is an altar, and they must pass by the altar and understand the altar. Then there's a mountain. They come to the top of a mountain. You ever been to the top of a mountain? Like a big mountain, the very top. We went to Vail a few years ago, and Heidi and I took one of these, you know, ski lifts and went all the way up, and then we climbed. We were almost at the pinnacle of this mountain. We could see miles and miles, and we were like standing in snow at the end of June. It was amazing. You could see, there was something just beautiful and glorious displaying the glory of God on the mountain. And in this story, what happens is they're called to come up the mountain where they see the glory of the mountain, but they also meet their God face to face. And they're saying, man, as beautiful as the mountain is, the evergreen trees and the snow caps and the beauty that we can see, what's even more beautiful, like what stole the show that moment, is they begin to gaze on their God. And as they were gazing on their God, they began to see the beauty of the God who is, who had met them, even though they didn't deserve it. And there's this crazy line that says, and God did not lay his hand on them. As we read and we understand this God, that's what we should have expected. They can't come before this God without it costing them. Nobody can look on God, but they do. It's a strange situation. We've already found this in the story. As you read Exodus, nobody can look on God, but they come see God. And the reason they can come see God is because they've passed by the altar and they see the glory of God on display. And so what happens is then there's a table where they sit and they have a meal with their God. Just picture the beauty of this. The picture of the God of the universe is now sharing a meal with these 74 people. Just hanging out, being with them. There's nothing more beautiful, more intimate than a meal, right? And this is what happens in this story as they are placing their faith in God who has rescued, who has redeemed, who has acted for them, who has done everything. They've done nothing. He's done everything. And now they're just responding by saying, you are ours and we are yours. And so what happens is the Bible paints this. It's painting a picture for us that shows us something, because we know that what happens is they leave this moment and from this point on, they're just messed up. In fact, Aaron himself just days after this experience is going to be building a golden calf at one of the worst stories in the Bible. Now, this morning I'm going to tell you that story because it's racy and it's terrible and it's like, really? This guy who was hanging out with God is now part of this story? But the hope here is not how well does Aaron do. The hope in the story is, what will God do? Is it Aaron's faithfulness or God's faithfulness that is their hope? And the answer all the way through is that it is God's faithfulness that is their hope. It is the covenant and the beauty of the blood spilt. And so what happens is we read the Bible, we see that they're utter failures, and all of a sudden we're like, all right, there's this beautiful story of the parting of the Red Sea and all this crazy stuff that went on, and God's delivered from slavery, and it's awesome, but it whets my appetite. There's got to be something more in the story. because this does not accomplish in those people what I think it should. And the Bible just keeps telling the story over and over in the Old Testament. They keep coming back to the story, but it starts whispering and promising that there is going to become a true deliverer, a day where God will act in another way. And then Jesus shows up, right? He lives this life, and he becomes everything that they're not. And he gets himself at odds with the Roman officials and the Jewish leaders, and they crucify him on a bloody Roman cross. And his blood is poured out. But then 3 days later, as his disciples feel hopeless, as the women who come to the tomb are just wondering even how are we going to get anywhere near Jesus' body, everything changes. And they come to the tomb, and in Luke 24, it tells us this amazing story, as Jesus is alive. Luke 24, beginning with verse 36. They were talking about these things, meaning the things that Jesus, the fact that there were rumors that Jesus was alive, but they just couldn't buy into it. And Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, "Peace to you." But they were startled and frightened, and thought they had saw a spirit. And he said to them, "Why are you troubled, and why do doubts arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that is I myself. Touch me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see that I have." And when he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet. And while they were still disbelieved for joy and were marveling, he said to them, "Have you anything here to eat?" And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate before them. Then he said to them, "These are my words that I have spoken to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled." In other words, Jesus just said there, everything in the Old Testament is about me. I am the completion of every story. Exodus should create an appetite, a taste in your mouth for something more. It's like going to Sam's and you get a sample, right? You taste the sample, you're like, "Man, that's really good, but that ain't enough. I got to have more of this." Every story in the Old Testament is like a Sam sample that says there's something more. And Jesus says, "Man, I'm the whole meal." Exodus is just the sample. I'm the meal. I'm what Exodus was leading you to. And he said to them, "Go." Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, "Thus it is written that Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem." Listen, this is what the story is telling us. Exodus tells us this really cool story of slavery and God's deliverance from slavery and his rescue of dead people and making them alive and bringing them to himself in this beautiful covenant where God has a relationship with this nation. But God's promise to Abraham was that all the nations would be blessed because of one seed, one descendant. And Jesus comes, and just like God acted there, he acted in Jesus. And our slavery to sin, our despair because death is the end, our hard, broken lives, and we just can't get past things in our lives. And man, there's some of you in here, you are lonely beyond knowing what to do with it. And some of you feel like everybody has abandoned you. And some of you feel like, "Man, there is illness and struggle, and I just can't get over this." And we all are staring at the fact that life is short. What do we do with this life? Soundbite religion will not help you when we get to those things. But that is not what the gospel offers. The gospel offers a God who steps into our story, who tells us, "I am a good God. I am for you. I want to rescue you. I want to redeem you." And then he acts. He comes in the person of Jesus. He lives the life I should have lived. He died the death that I should have died. When I look at the blood of the Old Testament of animal, it is just pointing me to the fact that someday somebody would take the death I deserved, and Jesus would pour his blood out. And there is in this whole story, there is a book, the Bible, as God is revealing himself, saying, "I will be your God, and you will be my people." And Jesus says, "That book is all about me." And there is an altar. The altar is a rugged cross where Jesus poured out his blood as a sacrifice for you and for me. And then there is a mountain Because on the third day, the entire glory of God, the glory of the God who showed up on the mountain, is now on display as Jesus walks out of a tomb. Are you comfortable with the idea that Jesus is alive? Have you forgotten how nuts that is? Have you forgotten how nuts it is for a guy to die on Friday and be eating fish with his buddies on Sunday? That doesn't happen. This changes everything. And then there's a table. And listen, this is what the Bible's trying to say. That the Bible is saying God has told his story, that we live our lives and are disconnected. And if all the Bible is just a bunch of platitudes saying, hope in God, trust in God, he'll be there. God has a plan for your life, and it doesn't go farther than that, that it's almost a frustrating book. But if the Bible is telling us that God has stepped into your story and invited you into his, then it is beautiful. But the path is the same. This is what I want you to hear. The path is the same. How do I go from a person who just kind of knows Easter, and Easter is just kind of, you know, it's a date that's just full of platitudes, and I go on about my life tomorrow. How do I make Easter my story? And the path is the same. I will be your God. You will be my people. I must realize that I am not my hope. I must come to an altar. And I must know that blood was poured out for me, and I must let the blood of Christ be sprinkled on my heart. I must stop at the altar. I have to. But then when I stop at the altar, I'm invited up the mountain where I see the glory. And we gaze on the beauty of a risen Christ that leads us to a table. A God who is not tweeting to us, he is sitting with us. He's involved in our lives. He's giving us hope day by day. He is with us through the hardship and the good and the beauty and the brokenness of our lives. And so this morning, the band's going to come up here, and we're going to sing about Jesus, and we're going to celebrate this table. And we're going to celebrate an opportunity for us to climb that mountain. And so if you're here this morning and your story is that you have not known Christ and you have not met him, I just want to tell you that this morning is a great chance for you to experience the risen Christ, to know that God has already acted on your behalf. And if you're here this morning and you are a follower of Jesus, Easter is another chance for us to hope and trust in this God who has redeemed us. And so what happens is communion is a picture of that table, of God literally coming and having a meal with us. And that meal is himself, that Jesus giving himself. It is a picture, like we take communion today because we also know that he's going to eat our meal tomorrow with us. So yesterday I'm on a bike with my girls. We're riding and we're looking at sycamore trees and just being at awe, like how beautiful. And Mary's just going, wow. And in that moment, as I talked with Mary, we have this tandem bike where she's like right behind me, just pedaling as hard as she can, right? You know, and we're talking, and I'm having this conversation about the fact that here I am in nature, and the God who was eating a meal with us this morning, who is here today, was enjoying a bike ride with us yesterday. He's invited us into his story. And the cross and the resurrection changes everything because it makes it possible. Jesus, we love you today. Just hope that this message will sink deep, that you will tell us that you have told your beautiful story in creation and in your word. Thank you for the promises that are made in Scripture and the hope of deliverance that has been given. In your name I pray. Amen. Hey, if you're here.